From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I was very torn during this process about being a participant in it, not because I don't support Kamala Harris. I do 1,000%, and I will be out there campaigning for her at every turn. But this job that I'm doing now, that we're making a big difference.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker. He was passed over for the vice presidential bid when it came to being Kamala Harris's running mate. But what is next for J.B. Pritzker as he moves forward? We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Charlie Wheeler is off again this week. Don't fear, he will be back with us next time. Today we have two of the top reporters in the state joining us, though. Hannah Meisel with Capital News Illinois. Hannah, it's always great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
And Brendan Moore with Lee Enterprises joins us. Brendan, thanks for being here as well.
Always a pleasure, Sean.
So, Brendan, let's start and put a bow on this story about the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats. Kamala Harris picked Tim Walz, the Minnesota governor, to be her running mate. J.B. Pritzker was apparently considered strongly. He was not selected. Pritzker, from everything I've read, seemed very interested in this position, but it wasn't to be. Were you surprised by that, or had you pretty much figured that Pritzker was not likely to get this position?
I wasn't surprised, and I think most people that watched this weren't really surprised. The governor was considered. He went through vetting interviews. He was one of six candidates who did, but he was always viewed as kind of an outside long shot candidate. There were some more obvious contenders in there. Governor Tim Walz from Minnesota, who ultimately got it, was considered a top candidate, along with Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania and Mark Kelly, senator from Arizona. Basically, it kind of came down to the governor could not really provide Vice President Harris an electoral benefit that maybe some of the other candidates could. Illinois is obviously a deep blue state, and the other states were a little bit swingier. Even though Minnesota is a bluish state, Governor Walz has more of a unique background that may help win over some, you know, voters in the Rust Belt, in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan. And so Governor Pritzker did not get this. And I think that, you know, he clearly was positioning himself to be on a national ticket, whether it was this year or in 2028, whether that was leading the presidential ticket, running for president himself, or being on the ticket with Vice President Harris. Obviously, that is out the that possibility is out the window now. But we will see what happens in the future. The governor has two more years left on his current term. He's up in 2026. Depending on how the election goes, presidential election goes in November, may not be the last time that we hear rumblings about him being on a national ticket. But for now, he is staying in Illinois. And if you heard any of the events that he was at this week, state legislators are happy he's staying, it seems. House Speaker Chris Welch said he's going to buy him a shot of Malort because he is he's sticking around. So the Veep Stakes is over, and we will just have to wait and see what happens in the future.
Yeah, Hannah, were you surprised, I guess, that he... I mean, I actually was surprised he made it as far in this vetting process as he apparently did because of just what Brendan had said when it came to the electoral benefit. But at the same time, your thoughts on him getting passed over for this, and what about his future?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's still very much an open question. You know, he has demurred every single time he's been asked about his presidential ambitions in the last, I don't know, 2-3 years. But, you know, those close to him have indicated that it is something on everyone's mind. Now it's a question, if Harris wins in November, unless something wild happens in her first 4 years, you know, most likely she would go for another term. And then, you know, you have a whole new set of, you know, we have no idea what the world's going to look like in 8 years. Governor Pritzker could run for a third term. But at that point, you're kind of settled into the job as governor. And of course, it's very important to have that executive experience, although, you know, we've had a lot of presidents that haven't had that before making their run for the White House. But it really remains to be seen. It's definitely his path to the White House is definitely a lot more complicated now than it would have been if he would have gone for the 2028. But, you know, like you said, Sean, I was also, I guess, a bit surprised that he made it as far as he did in the vetting process. He wasn't, of course, in the reported final two. Governor Walz and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro were those two. But, you know, like Brendan said, he doesn't really, being from a deep blue state like Illinois, you don't really bring a lot to the Democratic Party if you want to have kind of a crossover appeal. You're kind of, he's in the same boat, he's the same path as Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, a very progressive guy leading a progressive state. And so you don't have that experience to brag about, you know, working across the aisle. Not that in our politics these days, that is really something that happens a lot in Congress, in DC, but I think just traditionally, that is something that's valued. And even though I always like to mention that the number of true undecided voters is really a shrinking number, the people who are truly moderate, it seems to be, you know, that label is kind of land you in a no man's land to chase these so-called undecided voters. You know, I guess you could call it a sort of fool's errand, but, you know, he doesn't really bring that experience. So I guess we'll see.
So, Brendan, we mentioned there is a bit of a log jam at the national level now because there are some people out there. We mentioned Gavin Newsom before, Gretchen Whitmer, different people like that who might have a real idea that they want to run for president. So at least they're 4 years away from that happening, maybe longer. Here in Illinois, we're seeing something similar, though. I mean, we've got, especially among Democrats, there's a pretty deep bench starting to form. Got Alexei Janulius, you've got Susana Mendoza, not saying they want to run for governor. Of course, Juliana Stratton's in there and many others. But if Pritzker ends up running for a third term, it's going to keep other people down on the ballot, too. Everybody, after a while, wants to see people move on so they can move up.
There are a few key races to watch coming up. A few big decisions have to be made. Does Governor Pritzker seek a third term? Does Senator Dick Durbin seek another term in the Senate? He's going to be 82 at the start of what would be his next term. So a lot of people are not sure if he is going to. And I asked him actually this week, and he said he hasn't made his decision yet. He'll make it sometime in the new year. So 2026 could really be a big year in state politics and government, depending on what these two men decide. You know, we could see wide open races for governor and for U.S. Senate. As you said, Sean, I mean, there is a deep bench. Obviously, Alexei Janulius, the Secretary of State, is known to have ambitions beyond his office. You have people like Congressman Rasha Krishnamoorthy from suburban Chicago, who has raised a lot of money, stirring speculation that he may want to run for Durbin's seat if he retires. And then, yeah, I mean, you have a whole slew of constitutional officers from Juliana Stratton, I mean, Kwame Raoul, and up and down, you know, the state and local level in, you know, Democratic politics that will be looking at these seats. But obviously, none of that happens if Governor Pritzker runs for re-election, if Senator Durbin runs for re-election. It's very hard to knock off an incumbent. But you're very, you know, you're correct in that the bench is deep in Illinois. That's what happens when you win a lot of elections. I mean, they have all the constitutional offices and they have, you know, super majorities in the legislature. And obviously at the local level up in Cook County, you have a lot of very ambitious younger Democrats. And this is kind of what happens when you have people that stay in positions for a long time. I mean, Senator Durbin's going to be in there for 30 years at the end of his term. And obviously, you know, Governor Pritzker for, you know, for two terms, you know, you kind of have that logjam of talent, and we will see if it breaks in the next year or so.
Can I also just say, like, I feel like we wouldn't have been having the same conversation about a deep bench of talent a few years ago. And maybe I'm overstating it, but I feel like with the exit from politics for former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan, amid, you know, all of the corruption cases that were swirling around when he resigned from office in early 2021, you know, that kind of took the cap off of, you know, a lot of people were emboldened, especially progressives, to get more progressive and to kind of win this state and national attention. And I feel like, you know, that sort of energy begets other energy and buzz around these folks that wouldn't have maybe been there.
And I should also add to very quickly, I mean, I mentioned Congressman Krishnamoorthy, but there's also a lot of really young, there's also a lot of young people in Congress that are going to generate a lot of attention, from Delia Ramirez to Lauren Underwood, and are going to be viewed as leaders in the party moving forward, and, you know, candidates for a statewide run at some point, possibly.
Yeah, it's always hard to predict the future. In fact, Pritzker was not somebody that was on people's minds until he decided to run. And Bruce Rauner, I think you can make that same argument for. So we'll just continue to watch that. I do want to touch on some legislation that's been signed here in recent weeks, and both of you have followed these. Hannah, the state's grocery tax is going away. So when would this take effect?
Yeah, so January 1st, 2026, no more 1% tax on groceries in Illinois. Illinois was, I believe, among a minority of states that had a state grocery tax. And this was, I want to say, going back to February, if my memory serves correctly, a surprise bit in Governor Pritzker's budget address. He, as the office does before a budget address, given certain scoops to certain reporters about different pieces that he was going to present. But I believe that this was a surprise to everyone. Definitely a populist idea. If we go back to 2022, when inflation was really high, of course, an election year for statewide, for his reelection, Governor Pritzker presented the same idea, a six-month moratorium on the grocery tax, in addition to freezing the gas tax where it was, you know, going to be before its annual jump, which is tied to inflation. For all the hand wringing, you know, back in 2022, he felt it was worth it to bring this back. Of course, this spring, municipalities pushed back hard on this idea, but ultimately there was a compromise made, because the grocery tax, it doesn't go into state coffers. It's, you know, shared to municipalities. But so as a compromise to make up for that money, towns, villages, county, they're able to levy their own 1% grocery tax, even without a referendum for those non-home rule municipalities under 25,000 residents.
Now, in all respect to the governor, Brendan, I know he said every dollar helps, you know, when people are dealing with inflation, but we really are talking about just a few bucks here for most people. I don't know that most people will even notice this, the way that grocery prices often tend to fluctuate. Talk about that. And also, like Hannah had mentioned, there was a compromise reached with local governments. Were they happy with this compromise?
Yeah, I think it's more the principle than anything for the governor and folks that backed this repeal of this 1% tax, that it's inherently regressive because everybody buys groceries, whether you're rich or you're poor. So that 1% hits everybody equally. But obviously that has a disproportionate impact on people that have less disposable income. But as you said, Sean, I mean, it's maybe, I don't know, $50 to $100 a year, maybe for folks. I think that was kind of the estimate that some people doing behind the napkin math got. So it's not a lot of money for folks that are you know, buying groceries, but it was a lot of money for these municipalities, potentially, I mean, millions and millions of dollars for some of these municipalities that they relied upon in their budgets. And so they were against this at the beginning. But as you said, there was this compromise that allows for them to raise the tax themselves if they want to keep that 1%. And I believe there was also a provision in there that allowed, allowed non-home rule municipalities to impose a sales tax, just a general sales tax, without going through a referendum first as well. So, I mean, there were a lot of other things in that bill that that benefited municipalities and got them to the point where they ended up supporting the bill. It in Springfield, it just kind of shows that, you know, when an idea is introduced, that's not necessarily what it's going to look like in the final product. Another example was, I mean, originally, I believe it was going to go into effect at the beginning of the year. They pushed it back to 2026. So municipalities have a little bit more time to phase it in. So technically the grocery tax is gone at the state level, which again, good politics for the governor. Gets some good headlines. But in reality, municipalities will have the ability to reimpose it. So it's kind of just shifting, I guess, who the bad guy is in terms of having to impose a tax. But as you said, it's not a huge tax that's going to break the bank for anybody.
Well, there was another law that was signed. This one got a little bit more support among Democrats, a little less of a compromise effort here, Hannah. This it will go after employers who require meetings of their employees to discuss religious or political matters, and that can include, apparently, unionization efforts. So I guess they can have a meeting, require you to come, and rail against forming a union. Is that the way I understand it?
Right. These so-called captive audience meetings are a common tactic for companies when they, get wind that their employees are starting the unionization process. There was only one time in my career where I was part of the start of a union. Not that I was, it just happened to be the timing. There were lots of phone calls made. There was pressure put on to not sign the union cards. This, especially in these shops where, it might be lower wages, warehouse work, that sort of thing, pressure can be extremely intimidating. And so the argument from organized labor that was pushing this so hard, this is wrong. This is quote unquote indoctrination at work. And so the law says that employers cannot punish, can't garnish wages, can't, otherwise hurt people's employment for not going to these meetings. They're still welcome to have these meetings, but you can't make them mandatory as part of, your job and, reward or punish your employees for going or not going. So this Worker Freedom of Speech Act, it goes into effect on January 1st. But Illinois is the eighth state to have such a law. We've seen in, I believe, Minnesota and Connecticut, we've seen a business group sue over the law, saying it takes away their First Amendment rights. It chills free speech on behalf of the businesses. And as of yesterday, we saw a lawsuit filed here in Illinois over kind of the same thing. The Illinois Policy Institute, which longtime followers of Illinois government might remember from their greatest hits, such as Governor Bruce Rauner bringing in a lot of their top staff to replace his top staff after the quote-unquote purge in July of 2017. Didn't last all that long, very contentious. But the Illinois Policy Institute has been, I'll give them credit where credit is due. They're very, very good at social media marketing, creating content that, when you search for anything Illinois government related. They have the search engine optimization really, really, really optimized so that it might be the first or second thing that comes up in a Google search results. So that their message, this, you know, their libertarian message is getting out there. So as a 501c3, the Illinois Policy Institute sued. They were not, because 501c3s are not exempted from this law as 501c4s, 5s, and 6s are. 501c4s, advocacy groups, 501c5s, labor groups, 501c6s, business leagues, trade associations. The ACLU of Illinois, which is an advocacy group, had pushed for these exemptions in negotiations over this law this spring, saying, you know, it's possible that an unintended effect is we couldn't actually do our jobs because we have to talk about policy work. 501c3s, not exempted. But I thought it was very interesting, and I wanted to point out that the in this lawsuit that was filed yesterday, Illinois Policy Institute makes no mention of their twin organization, Illinois Policy, which is an advocacy organization that shares staff and offices, a website, has identical boards of directors. It is a 501c4. There is not a whole lot of meaningful difference between the two organizations. Many people have noted this throughout the years in the decade since it launched. So no mention of that in the lawsuit. We will see what happens. So, I mean, I think it's interesting because 501c3s also are the designation IRS gives to churches. And so we might see that argument being made down the line over this law.
Interesting. Just about a minute here, Hannah, real quick. Also, there's been some what I'd almost call cleanup language when it comes to this biometric privacy act that had been out there for a while. Just give us the overview of what that would do.
Right. The Biometric Information Privacy Act has spawned a lot of lawsuits in the last, especially 6 years, even though it's been in place since 2008. You know, it's the thing that was behind that giant Facebook settlement in 2020, where a lot of Illinoisans got that $400 or so check. Business groups have been pushing back on this law for a while. And finally, this spring, there was a bit of a compromise made, though a lot of business groups said it didn't go nearly far enough. But the basically, if you are in a job where you scan your fingerprint or have a retinal scan as part of your job to maybe open a cash register or go to a restricted area, instead of every single time you scan your thumbprint, that being a separate violation that could be $1,000 or $5,000 in violation, it would only count as once the time that your biometric information is initially collected.
Brendan, the governor this week took an opportunity, actually he's done this a few times, but he really came out pretty strongly when it comes to a case that has really gotten national attention, and it's right here in Sangamon County, this case involving the shooting death by a Sangamon County deputy of Sonia Massey. The governor says he's not heard enough from Jack Campbell, the sheriff, and he and both the lieutenant governor also wanting Campbell to step aside. Campbell has not done that, but anything you can add on that?
Yeah, Sean, as you said, the governor speaking very passionately this week on this topic, asking for Sheriff Campbell's resignation, really honing in on the sheriff's hiring of this deputy, now former deputy, and just questioning his judgment. As been widely reported, this deputy Sean Grayson, who's been now been charged with murder, was hired by six different departments, and had some other kind of questionable things in his background, but he was hired by the sheriff's department anyways. So Governor Pritzker has and Lieutenant Governor Sean called for his resignation, basically saying that trust cannot be restored between the community and the sheriff's department if he is still around. You know, the sheriff responded to the governor the other day basically saying that, you know, any call for his resignation is political maneuvering, that they followed all procedures, and that, you know, if there are changes that have to be made, then, you know, that would have to come from somewhere else, presumably the state. The governor did not like that response, and basically again put the onus on the sheriff and on his decision to hire this guy. That being said, we will likely see some type of legislation that comes out of this tragedy, whether that is kind of you know, requiring sharing of certain information among departments, you know, and other ways to kind of strengthen that process to make sure that, you know, information is shared. But we have not heard anything super specific yet. But that might be something to watch during veto session or during lame duck session. But yeah, the governor has been very passionate about this, you know, in a way that he isn't about a lot of issues. But I think as this case has struck a chord with him, as I think it has with a lot of people.
All right. Well, it's time now for our notes from the field. Hannah, let's go to you first.
Well, after more than 5 years in office and more than 7 years after Governor J.B. Pritzker began running for governor back in 2017, the Wall Street Journal, the Chicago Sun-Times, and Chicago Tribune this week announced they're finally going to change their policy on whether or not to have periods in J.B.'s name. J.B. himself spells it without the periods, but you know, for a very long time, these papers have held on to, you know, the kind of official style that initials always come with periods. So I guess we are just waiting for the Associated Press, the kind of ultimate arbiter of newspaper news style, to make their call.
All right. And Brendan.
Thursday was the opening of the Illinois State Fair, and the start is traditionally the cutting of the ribbon at the main gate. Governor Pritzker does that every year, and then he walks in to cut the ribbon at his own tent. Traditionally, during that walk over, reporters will lob some softball questions at the governor, some friendly questions. This year, we asked him about places that the Democratic delegates coming to Chicago in a few weeks should go to if when they're visiting the city. Governor told them to get outside of the convention hall area, go into the neighborhoods of Chicago, maybe get an Italian beef, since the city is known for that, especially now with the Bear, the TV show. And I should also add that my colleague Jeremy Gorner asked the governor what concerts he's looking forward to at the Illinois State Fair this year. And he mentioned the Smashing Pumpkins and Lil Wayne. Jeremy, of course, followed up, like, are you going to go see Motley Crue? And the governor said, well, you know me, I'm a headbanger.
Okay. All right. That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Brendan Moore with Lee Enterprises and Hannah Meisel with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.